The plane taxis to a halt. The door opens. We step down onto the tarmac and we walk out into another world. We've not arrived in Jerusalem or Galilee. This is Persia in the 5th century BC. And it's a world away from modern Britain. In fact, a world away from ancient Jerusalem or Galilee. And there we are, soaking up the heat and also the culture. We marvel at the buildings, but there are no churches, there are no Jewish synagogues or temples. And as we open in front of us the book of Esther this evening and over the next few weeks, don't assume, because this is in the Bible, that this story is set in a society bearing any of the marks of the God of Abraham, of Samuel and David. It was a world almost untouched by a belief in the one true God. And yet, this is the story of Esther. Good story? Was it a true story? Yes, Xerxes is as real a historical figure in history as Henry VIII. And all we read about him from other sources fits with the character that we meet in this book of the Bible. The Jewish people still celebrate the events recorded here in the annual Feast of Purim. And we're in no doubt long ago, and certainly not today either, about the fact that what actually happened here really did take place. And so off we go. And as we look into the first chapter, we see that it is dominated by King Xerxes. Let's start with verses 1 to 9. And we discover that Xerxes had plenty to boast about. And as we look down at the page, we see again that here was opulence and extravagance gone mad. Xerxes was ruler of the greatest empire in the world, the Persian Empire. In those days, he had stretched from India to what is now northern Sudan. And Xerxes followed in the footsteps of the great King Cyrus and then King Darius. And the inheritance that they handed down to him was immense. This was power, this was wealth, and he wanted everybody in his kingdom to see it. And so he organized a party. In fact, there were three parties. And as we look down the page, in verse 4, for example, it tells us that one banquet lasted half a year, and anybody who was anybody was invited. For a full 180 days, we read, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. It was a privilege to receive an invitation. No doubt it would be very unwise to turn it down. The second banquet lasted 7 days. And even those in the capital Susa who weren't anybody were invited, so that they could experience the affection of Xerxes for these his closest citizens. And they were treated to amazing gardens, gold furniture, marble pavements, gold goblets individually designed and crafted for everybody, and wine freely and constantly available. And everyone's particular needs were accommodated, so that no one could fail to be impressed with the king's lavish hospitality. Now, of course, we know even today that there's no such thing as a free lunch. And Xerxes coupled the entertainment for his military leaders with a council of war, planning a campaign against his greatest enemy, the Greeks. And he would also expect undying loyalty and obedience from his nobles and citizens in return. But I mentioned there were three banquets, and the third banquet in verse 9 we see was the women's program, with Queen Vashti, the beautiful hostess. And it is mentioned almost as an afterthought, plainly and briefly. She gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. Now, what does the writer of Esther think about this excessive extravagance? Well, interesting, there is no comment. With our 21st century consciences, we would be asking about poverty. We would be wondering, what is the boundary between generous hospitality on one hand and sickening criminal excess? And yet, even with our modern conscience, we are still fascinated by wealth. The Guardian recently devoted a page to the costs of the weddings of four top English footballers. Another paper revealed that a divorced couple spent £1.5 million on lawyers. In a fight over their £135 million property fortune, just to get a ruling on whether the court battle should take place in England or Spain. Today's equivalent to the wealth of Xerxes might be found in the art world. In the last 10 days, Francis Bacon's self-portrait sold for £21.5 million, double the estimated price. The chairman of the auctioneers, Sotheby's Europe, said, "At the top end of the market, there's immense wealth. It's all over the world." Now, of course, we're well aware today, if we think about it, that there may be immense wealth at one end, but there is even deeper poverty at the other. But again, in Xerxes' Persia, it is another world altogether. But we are left in no doubt that here was a king, almost uniquely, with plenty to boast about. But we must move on. And we're going to look now at verses 10 of chapter 1, right through over the page, eventually up to verse 4 of chapter 2. And we discover as we look at these verses that while he had plenty to boast about, Xerxes then discovered something to worry about. When we clear up after a party and we discover a large red wine or brown coffee stain right in the most obvious part of the new expensive carpet, it rather takes the edge off the event. And poor old Xerxes, he would remember that banquet for all the wrong reasons, and so would all the guests. But his reasons were far more disturbing to him than a stain on the carpet. Look at verse 10. "On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at." A drunken emperor orders his beautiful wife to parade herself before a crowd of men. But Queen Vashti did the unthinkable. She refused to cooperate. She stayed in her room. We might be thinking this is the ultimate smack in the eye for all men who begin to take their women for granted. And perhaps I can even sense the private smirks of admiration and satisfaction among some of the women here, even in All Souls. Now, of course, there were going to be consequences. She had humiliated her husband in full view of all his subjects, and therefore there was no question about it, she had to go. The Persians, famed for their laws and edicts, quickly issued a royal decree in verse 19. That Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. But as we read through these passages, we find that the crisis talks went further. After all, they began to talk to themselves, other wives might take Vashti's example as an inspiration for rebelling against their husbands. And to them, the prospect was alarming. And the all-male committee grimly sought to address the damage. And they produced another law, quickly delivered to all parts of the kingdom. This was an order, in verse 20, that all women will respect their husbands. And in verse 22, that every man should be ruler over his own household. One of the biblical scholars responding to this chapter makes quite a restrained comment, I think, that only a woman could make. The fears and exaggerated precautions of the men, she says, took little account of female psychology. She went on, "Women do not, as a rule, support one another as readily as men in taking concerted action," which I take to mean she's saying that men tend to get more frightened about these things. But anyway, on reflection, these advisers were not doing Xerxes any favors. They would have been wiser to play it cool, because the message that was actually being delivered right round the kingdom was, in effect, here is the most powerful man in the world, unable to control his own wife. Now, the question might just pass through our minds, was Vashti right? Was she right to stay in her room? and publicly humiliate her husband. Well, the writer makes no comment. It's not a relevant question. As far as we're concerned, it is simply a feature of the story, which will open the door to a promise of a new queen. And as we get into chapter 4, we are getting to the point where 4 years are passing between the end of the parties and what happens next. If a nation goes to war and triumphs, it can reflect well on the leaders. Some of us have seen that in our own lifetimes. But if there is defeat, or it ends in controversy, it reflects badly on the leaders. Xerxes set out to invade Greece. This was very dear to his heart. It doesn't tell us about it here, but we know about it from other records of history, because he failed. And in fact, his navy was comprehensively defeated by the Greeks. It would have been a terrible blow to Xerxes. And as we get into chapter 2, we find that he's actually in not such a good mood. He couldn't help looking back to Vashti. And it seems, as we look at verse 1, that time had left him saddened by the way that his former queen had been treated. And so the personal advisors come on the scene again, and they begin to feel that all this looking back is not healthy. In fact, they recommended a search for a successor to Queen Vashti. Let me read what they had in mind, verses 2 to 4. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. And then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king. You can almost hear him muttering that he was beginning to feel better already. But anyway, so the king gave his consent, and with it the spotlights turn away from Xerxes to a very unlikely new celebrity. And her Jewish name, we discover as we look at verse 5 onwards, was Hadassah, which means myrtle. But she was also known by her Persian name, which is Esther. And we're told from verse 7 that Esther was very beautiful. She is described as lovely in form and features. And Esther was to prove the perfect candidate for the king's new queen. Now let's look through the rest of this chapter again quite smartly. Verses 5 to 11 first of all. And as we read these verses, we discover about Esther that she had something to be secretive about. Look at verse 5. "Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai." You can almost sort of feel the change of tone, because Esther and her guardian Mordecai were Jews. Their ancestors had been captured and transported into exile into Babylon, which had then been taken over by the Persians. And now, 130 years on, they were a part of Persian society. But nobody ever could forget that these Jews were a displaced ethnic minority. And so Esther, for all her beauty, was vulnerable. Just think about it. She's without parents. She's living in a foreign land and hiding, as it were, under a foreign name. And when Esther was included among the girls to make up the royal harem, Mordecai ordered her to keep her roots secret. Look at verse 10. "Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so." Reading the story, it's not always clear whether Mordecai is always protecting her or sometimes using her. But again, it's not important to decide one way or the other. But it is worth pausing at that point, because human beings have a poor record when it comes to ethnic minorities. I don't know what it is exactly, but there seems to be a sinister racism inside many of us. A racism which, given the opportunity, can lead sometimes to the most appalling atrocities. We know about the Holocaust and the war. We know about Yugoslavia, the Sudan, Rwanda, Nigeria in the 1960s and so on. Often forgotten is the 1915 Holocaust of Armenians. Nearly a century on, Robert Fisk's account of the genocide makes very chilling reading. He writes, "Turkey's reign of terror was an attempt to destroy the Armenian race. The death toll was almost 1.5 million. It's not just condemning past regimes, but holding ourselves as present-day Christians to account for our own inner attitudes towards those of races other than our own. And it's worth remembering as we look at this particular story that in Esther's day, no Jew, Mordecai, Esther and the others, no Jew could ever relax and feel safe. And so we move on to verses 12 to 18. And here we read that Esther had plenty to be submissive about. Now you may, as I'm talking here, just be running your eyes down the page, verses 12 to 18. Because the storyteller explains the process in some detail. Let's begin by looking at verse 12. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. Only after a girl had completed these 12 months of beauty treatments was she considered ready to spend a night with the king in his palace. And perhaps I should say immediately, there is no biblical warrant for spending 2 hours in front of the mirror every day. But nearly all of these young girls presumably looked very attractive, even without any beauty treatments. Nearly all of them would then take their place in the harem, hundreds of them. And only one would be chosen to become the queen of King Xerxes. Now as we read, perhaps we're interested to see, perhaps we're surprised to see, that Esther not only complied, and she went along with all that was required, but she was a model recruit. She impressed the man in charge of the harem in verse 8. She impressed everybody who saw her, it says in verse 15. And finally, and crucially, she impressed the king. And all the other contestants paled by comparison. Verses 17 to 18. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. And so he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. It's pointless asking whether Esther was right to be submissive to such a system. The writer's verdict? Well, again, it's not given. There's no comment. Nor are we told whether she had any choice in what she did. And we are not here again to judge another person in the light of our distant scruples. We cannot be sure she knew how the rest of the story would unfold. And that though it is natural to have our own view about what other people do and how other people behave, sometimes we have to remember to temper our condemnation of other people where we're not actually sitting where they do. So we may not point the finger at individuals, but generally we can't avoid speaking out about any system that seems to treat people, and when I say people, I mean that women are very often the victims, as in this case, simply like possessions. Opening up this story, we must remember that just because it is included in the Bible does not mean that what is here presented in this chapter is the teaching of the Bible, because most certainly it is not. And whether normal in that culture of Persia or not, this reeks of male domination. Now compare that with Jesus. Never do we find Jesus taking women for granted, using them for his own selfish desires or needs. On the contrary, he went out of his way to give them dignity and respect. He was never patronizing them or belittling them. And the New Testament tells us that in Christ, women and men are equal. So like with racism, we have to take care that we don't have our own less direct ways of dominating those of the opposite sex. And when you look at our society today, you realize that even in this country, we have a long, long way to go. Many years ago, my wife and I, over a period of years, got to know a prostitute who lived nearby and occasionally came to the church. And as time went on, it emerged that as quite a young girl, I think about 10 or 11, her mother sold her for sex. It was a way of life that became ingrained in her, the only one she knew. So much so that I can remember her telling us one day that she trusted nobody. Having tried our best to help while we knew her, we were devastated to hear later that she had taken the tragic route out of her captivity by taking her own life. In June, the newspapers ran stories about dedicated teams of senior prosecutors in the United Kingdom's so-called honour-killing hotspots. And the whole business of forced marriages offends most of us, I'm sure. But attitudes suggesting some measure of male superiority can find their way even into Christian churches, when perhaps young men feel that the person they select, as it were, to marry is primarily a matter of their choice. Submission within marriage and within relationships in general is a very precious biblical characteristic. If it ever loses its biblical balance, if it ever loses its setting of equality and love, then it ceases to be voluntary submission and takes us closer to some form of domination and oppression. And sadly, the church can never guarantee that we will always get this right. Now, all this may seem a far cry from what strikes us as the very inhuman culture in which Esther was groomed for the king's pleasure. And for her, it was enforced submission all the way. Now, it's not time at this juncture, because we've only had nearly the first couple of chapters. It's not time to summarize the story. It's only just begun, and I would suggest that you don't miss next week's very exciting installment. But nor are we ready to reach any kind of conclusions. And yet, before we go this evening, let's suppose we were Esther and put two questions to ourselves, like she might have done herself. And the first of these questions is, where am I? I wonder if you had that experience sometimes of actually maybe going on holiday and you wake up and you're a bit bleary and you look around and you think to yourself, where on earth am I? And I just wonder if Esther sometimes woke up and thought to herself, I can't believe this. Here I am surrounded by people, but in one sense, effectively on my own. I am a woman, I am a Jew, in a highly dangerous place, in a totally foreign environment. I'm caught up in a secular system. I'm in it right up to my neck. I feel I have no option but to go with the flow, stick with the rules, and do what's expected of me. But then many people here, even, might find themselves in a very similar position. You may look around yourself at work, even at home maybe, and you think to yourself, I'm the only one, or at least part of a very small minority. You think to yourself, there are good people around me. They're as dedicated to their work as I am. Most of the time, you all get on with the job and with everybody else. But there isn't that underlying sympathy or understanding for who I am as a Christian, for what I stand for, and for what I believe. Esther, I hope we're discovering, even as far as we've got so far, is a person who would identify completely with that experience. She had this job to do. She did it to the very best of her ability. Sometimes it must have felt in direct conflict to the ideals and standards to which she, as one of God's people, was committed. But for us, even to come tonight and to look at Esther, to see her in that situation, is bound to be some kind of encouragement. Here was a young girl winning the appreciation of those responsible for her. In fact, she rose to the very top, the Persian king's wife, with all the potential for influence that that could bring. But pinching herself as to how she found herself in this situation, she asked him, guessing, of course, not only, where am I? But the other question, and where is God? And if you've ever read through the book of Esther, you know it's very difficult to find God actually written down here. In fact, he isn't. There is no direct reference to God in this book. He doesn't even get a mention. Now, I reckon Esther knew the story. Stories of people that she had heard about from her earliest years. And she would have known the story of Joseph, that young brother who was sold into slavery in Egypt. She would know that story only too well. Now, Joseph found himself not in a harem, of course, but rather unfortunately in the arms of his boss's wife. We're not told what she looked like, but we do know that she was a very unsavory character. And it was certainly not Joseph's idea that he was to be dispatched into prison for a long and undeserved punishment. And no doubt Joseph in his day would wake up sometimes and pinch himself and wonder, where am I? But like Esther, he steadily won the favor and the trust of those around him. And like Esther again, he rose to the very top to be the Egyptian Pharaoh's right-hand man with all the influence that such a position would give him. Now, there are obvious similarities between Esther and Joseph, and I'm sure they weren't lost on Esther in her situation, although it is no repeat story. There are plenty of differences as well. But in Genesis, following the life of Joseph, whatever the depressing and confusing outlook that Joseph faced, we often come across this short sentence, "And the Lord was with Joseph." And perhaps I could say to you as I come to the end tonight, wherever you find yourself, wherever you find yourself, remember this. Joseph, in prison, in Egypt, wherever he was not on his own. He was not forgotten. He was never out of range of God's love. The foreign, secular environment in which he was living and working did not separate him from God. And when you read this extraordinary story of young Esther in front of us this evening, and you see nothing about God that is actually said, or certainly written down, perhaps we are sure that she was able, even so, to hear quiet echoes of what Joseph did. And she knew that as the Lord was with Joseph, so the Lord was with her when she felt alone, and that he would strengthen her for whatever lay ahead. And if she heard that message from God, that reassurance from God, somewhere deep inside her, so can we.